So the retreat is rolling right along, and there's really we're definitely moving toward the end part of the retreat. So to encourage everybody to use these last couple days skillfully. And you're reviewing some of the, in your own mind, reviewing some of the teachings and also the practice that you've been doing, trying to consolidate it and to gain a steadiness and clarity in your own practice. And this is, you know, one of the lists of teachings that the Buddha gives is the four bases of success, the iddhipadas, chanda, viriya, citta, vimamsa. Chanda is desire, interest, viriya is effort, citta is applying the mind, vimamsa is investigation, but it has a particular meaning of kind of reviewing, so that one reviews one's experience, and then of course that helps to feed back into that support of interest and desire, motivation in the practice. Ajahn Chah once said that when he went to receive teachings from Ajahn Mun, one of the teachings that Ajahn Mun gave, or that what Ajahn Chah remembered, was that Ajahn Mun said to practice in the shape of a circle. And Ajahn Chah at that time sort of said, "What the heck does he mean by that?" This is a good example of that, where the Buddha's teachings tend to loop around and support the teaching, so that one, say, just like that, the four bases of success, of motivation, of effort, of application of mind, contemplation, and then a natural result of that will be increased motivation, desire, which feeds the whole cycle. So you're practicing in the shape of a circle, so that you're gaining experience, so that then it helps to feed the roots and nourish the roots of the practice again, and it keeps the practice keeps fresh that way. It keeps and it isn't as if it's a point A to point B type practice, linear path, that you start as a new practitioner and you just go straight to some kind of realization. And so there's these circles that you keep you know, feeding into and nourishing and supporting. That was when Ajahn Chah first went to England. That was his one of his comments when they're taking him around, driving here, driving there, showing him different places or visiting different groups, and of course in England you have traffic circles. You don't have so many stoplights. You've got a lot of traffic circles, and so he said, "Oh, this is just like Eightfold Path." It's all these traffic. It's not just sort of stop and go. It's just you keep going, and you go into a circle, and you go out, and you keep. So these circles are you know, we keep paying attention to how to so that our practice loops back into supporting our and giving a stability, continuity of our practice. another image that Ajahn Chah used in developing the practice is one of and of course he's a northeastern Thai and from a rural area, and sort of a lot of kind of agricultural similes sometimes, certainly. And he said, it's just like planting rice. You know, when you you meditate and you develop mindfulness, and you wonder, what the heck is going to happen here? Where is it going? And he said, because like it's similar to planting rice in that when you first plant rice, you throw the seeds out. You're sort of seeding the ground. You throw these. It's just like rice is something you eat, and you just throw it away. But you have to be willing to do that in order for the new plants to take root and to grow and to be able to get a proper crop. So that in practice as well, we have to be willing to. Maybe we don't see the results and the benefits immediately. You have to be willing to put that attention in, put that effort in, put that care in. And at first it might feel one's sort of throwing it away and not getting a tangible result, but there's a natural process of growing and maturing that takes place in the heart. And so we have to have a certain amount of trust and then also a certain amount of experience of in our own experience seeing things taking root and seeing changes that take place in us, seeing a certain degree of clarity and mindfulness developing, and then trusting in that process that it will continue to grow, like pretty much everything else in nature. It isn't as if we're so separate and so unique that say natural cycles don't actually apply to us. It's really important to just reflecting in these ways. So that cultivation of our mindfulness, cultivation of the taking care and attention with the meditation object. with mindfulness of breathing. Like last night there was a question about bringing the attention, returning to the body. And I think it's an important foundation to develop, that developing that mindfulness that returns to its anchor, returns to its base. And the body is a stable, solid base. As I think I said it earlier in the retreat, but just that, and I oftentimes bring it up as a recollection that at least the body is always in the present moment, so that you can return to the body sensation that brings you back into the present. Emotional level of either excitement or frustration. One can be projecting outside of one's immediate experience, in terms of thoughts and views and ideas, realm of ideas. One can be incredibly distant from the present moment experience. But to bring attention back to the body, back to the rhythm of the breath. And grounding that awareness in the breath in the body. Sometimes we try to be too focused, too concentrated, too tightly controlling of the meditation object. So it's like sometimes just trying to just hold the meditation object, say at the tip of the nose, which is a common point for the meditation object to develop. But if it's held too tightly, then it's not comfortable. And if it's not comfortable, then you're not going to be able to sustain the mindfulness and awareness. So the mind is not going to settle as well as it could. So learning how to experiment with the breath, experiment with the whole sensation of the breath as it passes the tip of the nose, goes past the back of the throat, the chest area, down to the abdomen rising, the breath coming out, the abdomen falling, the coming out past the chest, the throat, the tip of the nose, following that whole sensation, following the sensation of how the breath feels within the whole body. So that grounding our experience of the breath in a sphere of mindfulness that is not too tight, not too limited. Especially if we begin like that. Then the mind will tend to either get tired physically, sometimes it gives you headaches. On a mental, emotional level, it'll easily be something that feels the mind starts to feel a bit constricted. So that one wants to be able to allow the sense of ease to permeate both the body and the mind, that sense of ease, so that there's kind of a natural one doesn't want to be so laissez-faire and easeful that one's either falling asleep or just sitting there drifting and daydreaming. So there's a balance that we need to be paying attention to. One of the images that has always stuck with me from my time living in Thailand is watching when we go in alms round in the early morning. It'd be the time when usually the young children from the village would be taking the buffaloes out to their fields, and these water buffalo are big and they're strong. They use them for work in the fields, but it's these kids are are the ones that are sort of have the responsibility or duty to control them, so that there's enough of a, you know, they've got a rope through their nose, but it's a, you know, it's a long enough rope that the kids can just sort of, and the can just sort of pull on it from time to time to lead the buffalo along. And if even if one were sort of a, you know, a grown person who was really strong, even if you tried to grab that buffalo by the, say, that rope right at the nose and sort of make it follow along exactly how you want each step of the way, nobody could control that. The buffalo is just going to rebel. He's not going to. He's going to resist. That's just the nature of it. If you took the buffalo out of its pen in the morning and sort of told it, well, you know, go out and have a good day and come back in the evening. It's not going to work either. But you've got quite a long rope, and you can. It's got enough room to sort of wander along and sort of graze a bit along the way. And sometimes, if it starts wandering off and distracted, then the little kid will just give it a pull, and it'll continue along its way. So that, you know, similar with the mind, you can't be forcing it. You can't be constraining it too much. You have to be willing to lead it. And if you think that just because you're an adult, that your mind is mature, you haven't looked at your own mind very long. So that just learning how to give it some boundaries, give it some encouragement, but having that kind of balance, so that one is leading it and encouraging it, so that taking the breath and attending to the breath, but not in too forced or too coercive a way, bringing attention into the body so that it's a bit broader base of attention, and also in a way that helps the body and the mind to be relaxed and expansive to a certain degree. The thing is once the mind starts to settle, once the mind starts to become interested in the meditation object, the natural inclination is that it's going to start honing in on its own accord, because that's what it's interested in. It wants to be peaceful. It wants to be to see more clearly in a more refined way. It's just quite natural. So to support that natural process, and that's one of the, how do you say, you know, key factors of our practice, is learning how to get that balance of encouraging the mind, but not raising the bar, but not coercing it. And that's a really important skill that we have to experiment with. So that using the breath as the object, sustaining attention on the breath in ways that feel comfortable, at ease, but also recognizing that one doesn't have to exclude anything from the breath, and so that the experience of the breath can encompass other aspects of our experience. And so, in the in the mindfulness of breathing discourse that the Buddha gives. There's all these different steps and stages to the the cultivation of mindfulness of breathing, but one is also attending to different aspects of experience at the same time, so that and it follows the pattern of the four foundations of mindfulness, so that experiencing joy, I breathe in. Experiencing joy, I breathe out. It's in the realm of feeling. Vedana, experiencing happiness, I breathe in. Experiencing happiness, I breathe out. Experiencing the mental formations, citta sankhara, I breathe in. Experiencing the citta sankhara, I breathe out. Calming the mental formation, the citta sankhara, I breathe in. Calming the mental formations, I breathe out. And so that this is the citta sankhara, are the basic, what constructs the mind, what forms the different thoughts and emotions, and so that one is experiencing that, recognizing that. One's still breathing in, paying attention to the in-breath, paying attention to the out-breath, but one's understanding and recognizing what is it that's going on in the mind that is welling up and creating the momentum of thoughts and ideas and emotions and projections of the mind. And it's because one has a well-grounded awareness in the breath as it comes in and the breath as it goes out, that one's able to see that process more clearly. It isn't because one's thought through it just from a rational intelligence, but it's that one has seen it and experienced it. So that grounding attention and awareness in the breath is a major conditioning factor for being able to see clearly, to see through the habits of the mind. Attention to the breath is not limited to only concentrating on the sensation of the breath. One has that as the foundation, but one is able to there's a sphere of awareness that encompasses the other realms of experience. It's just like, you know, I'm sitting here, and right now my primary focus is on the microphone, but I can still see and know people who are sitting in the front here. I can get a general field of what the feel of the room is. And so that's it's not exclusive. So that, and sometimes we forget that and think that, oh yeah, well, I've got to have my attention on the breath. I've got mindfulness of breathing. Well, I can't do anything else. So it's actually, it's kind of uncomfortable and unnatural. So to be able to bring that attention and recognition of how to develop the meditation, develop peaceful states of mind in a way that is sustainable, and that cultivating a sense of ease and awareness it's incredibly satisfying. So that to take an interest in it, how to do that. As we continue to continue our practice, there's the Ajahn Yatiko brought up the themes of samatha and vipassana. These are two broad ways that one applies the mind. Samatha in the sense of settling, of calming, of bringing the mind to tranquility, focusing. That is one way that we apply the mind. The vipassana element, insight, investigation, reflection, analysis even, those are a different way of applying the mind, and they work together. Ajahn Chah, one of the images he used was that the samatha is like an unlit candle, and that it's got potential, but it doesn't give off much light. So it's there. And then vipassana is like, it's like a match, which it's got kind of, you strike the match and it burns brightly for a short period of time, but it doesn't have, it isn't sustainable because it doesn't have much fuel. It's just a little match. So this is why samatha and vipassana have to actually work together. And one strikes the match, one lights the candle. Then you've got something that gives a light for a longer period of time over and able to sustain itself. So that sense of samatha supporting vipassana, and similarly vipassana supporting samatha, they're mutually supportive and mutually beneficial. So to be able to nurture that, both those elements of the mind. As we develop the sustaining of attention on the meditation object and on the mindfulness of the breath, and recognizing the different elements of content within the mind. There is a certain necessity to learn how to just learning how to drop the tendencies of the mind to proliferate, and there's a Ajahn Chah would say, tell us over and over again that there's only, two things that you need to be doing in meditation: knowing and letting go. just those two things, just that sense of establishing a quality of knowing, awareness, and then letting go, dropping, relinquishing. And that quality of relinquishment and letting go, dropping, is, I say, it has to be grounded in that clarity of awareness, as opposed to just pushing away experience, that dropping experience because one doesn't like it, doesn't want it, shouldn't be that way. That sense sets up a certain tension in the mind, whereas the quality of knowing clearly and then relinquishing, there's an ease and a kind of expansive quality to the mind that naturally occurs. It's like such a relief to put a mood down, such a relief to put a thought down, as opposed to if we're letting go out of an idealism of that's what we think we should be doing, then that letting go will be accompanied by a certain tension. I guess we're pushing it away. We're not allowing it to drop. So that to experiment with that relinquishment, experiment with that letting go, experiment with that aspect of how to put things down without pushing it away, how to put things down without picking it up again. And so it's an interesting framework of how to cultivate the meditation. There's a discourse in the Samyutta Nikaya where the Buddha is talking about the different spiritual powers, and he's describing and sort of faith, effort, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom, discernment, and then the Buddha is sort of asking the rhetorical question: and what is the power of concentration, the spiritual power of concentration of samadhi? And the Buddha defines it in this sense of the relying on relinquishment as the object of attention, so that one is cultivating that relinquishment, letting go, as the object of attention, and that's where the quality of concentration and power, spiritual power of concentration, comes to a kind of fruition. There's also, there's a very well-known discourse in the suttas where the Buddha is giving instruction to Moggallana, who has recently ordained, putting forth a lot of effort and kind of experiencing sloth and torpor, drowsiness, and sitting there nodding, so that which I always find very encouraging. if Moggallana can nod off in meditation, then there's hope for all of us. And that's the discourse where the Buddha gives all these different ways of dealing with drowsiness. It's a whole long list of different ways of dealing with drowsiness, which most people have probably heard already. But the discourse actually goes on after that instruction, the Buddha continues his instruction and talks about the different ways of to live as a monk, in particular, not engaging in a lot of conversation, familiarity with lay people, not getting into competition with anybody. And then the discourse finishes with the Buddha giving Moggallana the kind of instruction in sort of the kind of a summary of all the teachings. And sort of this is this is kind of the heart of my teaching, and the heart of a teaching that'll take you to liberation. And in the Pali, it's sort of sambhe dhamma nalanga piniwesaya, which means, saying, yeah, all things, all dhammas are not to be clung to. And it's a very simple, very direct teaching. All of these various things that we can experience, whether they're good or they're bad, or whether we like them, we don't like them, whether they're refined or coarse, whether they're internal or external, none of it is to be clung to. None of it is to be held on to. I say it's all to be relinquished. So that taking that theme of relinquishment is a it's a very powerful tool for our practice. It's also a really helpful way of just curbing that tendency of the mind to proliferate. All the addictions that human beings are capable of, and none of it holds a candle to the addiction to proliferation. That's the summum bonum of what we do as proliferators. curbing that tendency, seeing through that tendency for proliferation. There's a very beautiful discourse where Anuruddha he's one of the foremost disciples, cousin of the Buddha actually, another one, and he's meditating in the forest and reflecting on the Dhamma, and he has this sense of insight into these are what the thoughts of a great being are, and he comes thinking through these are the seven thoughts of a great being, and the thoughts of modesty rather than self-aggrandizement. Thoughts of contentment rather than thoughts of discontent. Thoughts of seclusion rather than thoughts of entanglement. Thoughts effort, putting forth effort rather than thoughts of laziness, thoughts of mindfulness rather than being thoughts of being sort of being confused, thoughts of concentration or thoughts of the mind being centered rather than the thoughts of the mind being diffuse and scattered. Thoughts of discernment rather than thought and wisdom rather than thoughts of confusion. It's very After spending a day in meditation, he comes back and tells the Buddha what he had been contemplating, and the Buddha said, praised him. Good, great, Anuruddha. Those are you know, seven thoughts of a great being. But you should add one more, so that it's the eight thoughts of a great being. And then the last one is thoughts delighting in non-proliferation. Rather than delighting in proliferation. And that's sort of, that raises the bar for a great being. So that sense of you know, taking that non-proliferation. One of the ways that, or the way that Ajahn Jeff translates proliferation is, the word in Pali is papancha. And because non-proliferation is nipapancha, but the way that Ajahn Jeff translates the word papancha is objectification, which is a really interesting translation and way to approach what happens in the mind in order to start the ball rolling on proliferation. And we objectify. Something becomes an object, which we then, of course, and once it moves, say, moving from its base, then there's that objectification of something being, something other, something else, and then it keeps spinning. It has its own life to it then. So that, and I think that's one of the reasons why, when we chant on the qualities of the Dhamma, one of the qualities is opanayiko. It's leading inwards, so that this Dhamma is leading inwards rather than, say, leading outwards into objectification and proliferation. So that. Drawing that attention inwards, returning to that base of awareness and knowing, and looking after it, nurturing it, caring for it, being attentive to the ways that we can support that quality of clear knowing, clear awareness. So I'll offer that for reflection this morning.